This is 105 Drive.
The charity that uses art to work with those with mental health difficulties, it's Lifecraft, is planning a poetry reading in the Mill Road Cemetery. They're working alongside the Independent Film Trust. And with me this afternoon, I've got Neil McCartney. He's the chairman of IFT, alongside Claire Crossman, who does work with Lifecraft as well. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Welcome to 105. Claire, let me start with you. So how are you involved with Lifecraft?
Well, I'm working for Lifecraft on a project called Time to Change, which is a national initiative funded by Mind and Rethink to enable people who have lived experience of mental health problems to talk about their experience and challenge the people who've never had that experience to think about them as people. It's really about ending any sort of discrimination against people who have mental health problems.
It's a horrible thing to happen to people, isn't it, really? Both the person who it happens to and also those around them is the issue
as
well.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about it that, you know, real mental illnesses are completely devastating events and they are conditions that people have to live with, and that the people around those people have to come to terms with and understand about that particular person. So it's they are illnesses in the same way as somebody who, you know, has a very bad back or has cancer. It's on the same kind of spectrum, really.
And I guess the thing is, with a lot compared to so many other illnesses, if you've got a spot on your nose, then people can see that straight away.
Yeah,
but of course, if it's a mental illness, it's inside and you just can't tell.
It's a hidden, I suppose you could think of it as a hidden disability. And I think a lot of people, even now in the early 21st century, you know, can't talk about it or keep it to themselves because they're aware that people might be thinking, isn't that, are you making this up? You know, it's something, it's because it's embedded in one's own feeling and experience. I think people who don't suffer from it find it more challenging to cope with than, say, where you, as you say, where you can actually see somebody's got a bandage on their arm or
Precisely. And Neil, the Independent Film Trust, do a lot of work with students, I think, for example. What other things, projects, do you get involved in?
Well, we, amongst other things, run basic filmmaking courses for disadvantaged people, by which I would mean people who wouldn't ordinarily get the chance. We did, in fact, run a course a couple of years ago with some people from with Westminster Mind, the Westminster Division of the Mental Health Charity. That was for adults recovering from mental health problems like depression and addiction. And we worked with an arm of Westminster Mind called Portugal Prince, which provided a kind of halfway house for people recovering from these problems to find their way back into the world of work. So they'd come to this place and work for a few hours, or the thing is, they printed things like greetings cards and business cards, but they're also counselling there as well. We ran these courses, workshops, alongside what they were doing there already, and it was very, very successful. They produced some very interesting films, and one of which actually got into the Raindance Film Festival in London entirely on its own merit, without any special pleading at all. And that particular person was, you could see he'd been through a rough time. Yeah. We never knew what it was. We weren't told, and of course, that's quite right, no one should tell us, but he had something he wanted to say, and he finally found that film was the medium.
And gave him his voice, as it were,
yes.
Yeah. To do so. So how did you get involved with Lifecraft? Because you live in Cambridge, of course. But
yes, I know of Lifecraft. I did see the other day when we had, some of our films were in the Cambridge City Council Disability Sports and Arts Festival a couple of weeks ago. There were some screenings at the Arts Picture House where there were some films made by people at Lifecraft. There were some made, some of ours as well. We were already working, we were planning to work with Lifecraft on the filming of a performance that they're putting on as part of the Romsey Arts Festival in August. So this is the production called The Blue Moon Cafe. And that's going to be performed at 11 o'clock on the morning of Saturday, the 3rd of August. So we're going to be filming that. That's at the Black Cat Cafe in Mill Road. So we're going to be filming that. And we'll probably do some other things in the Romsey Arts Festival as well. And it was while talking about those that this topic of the poetry readings came up. We thought, well, why don't we film that as well? Because, I mean, it'd be very interesting to... It's a shame if these things happen and are done live and then there's nothing on the record at all. There's no... nothing you can show to anybody else, nothing you can have in your archive to say, that's what we did last year. So that's what we're trying to do here.
It's strange, because historically, you know, whatever the performance has been, be it professional, be it amateur, be it in between, if it's on the stage, then for the most part, it is lost, isn't it?
Yes, yes. But the thing is, today it doesn't have to be like that. It is possible to, you know, it doesn't cost a lot these days to film something and, you know, get hold of it. And we work a lot with students at Anglia Ruskin, which again is nearby to here, particularly the people who are doing the BA in Film and Television Production or the BA in Film Studies. And because they're very keen to get experience in what is it like to film an event.
Ample supply of students, I'm sure, who are more than willing to get involved in projects like this. And the venue you've chosen, of course, is neatly halfway, or near enough halfway anyway, between the Ruskin and ourselves at Cambridge 105 on Gwydir Street, and that's the Mill Road Cemetery.
Yes. Well, it did occur to us that would be very handy. And as it happens, there are two of the people who are doing the filming on Wednesday. They're on a work placement at the moment. It was the only day they could do it. It was the only time that Claire's group could do it. And the two filmmakers have got to be off for London for doing a course with the Rain Dance organisation in London. So, you know, timing is important. We've got to get the equipment from ARU, get it to wherever it is, get it back again. So very handy to have it here. And the there's very atmospheric corners of Mill Road Cemetery.
And also, on the writing project that's been running for 9 months now at Lifecraft, all the writing hasn't been about people's experience, because we've actually now got a group of really talented writers. So we've got a project over the summer where we're going out and around, and we have actually been out into Mill Road and done writing about Mill Road.
I was going to ask the kind of topics which people are writing about, not necessarily the illness, so it could be...
No.
I guess, did you give them a particular brief?
Well, because people have written very personally, we're now looking at places, and over the last few weeks we've been doing some shared writing called Arenga, which we set on Mill Road, because everybody knows that place so well, because Lifecraft's based there and it's a kind of oasis for lots of people to come to all the time. And we did go up to the cemetery in the winter and just have a walk and a look round, and just because sometimes, you know, it's good to get out of the room you're in and actually respond to the place that's round about you. So over August we will be continuing this, and we will be going to Grantchester Meadows, and we've been to Wising Arts.
And the poems which are going to be recorded by Neil and the team from the Ruskin, some of those actually are about the cemetery itself.
Well, some of them are actually about the Mill Road area. And I'm hoping that after we've done the filming, we'll get time to start some new writing for later on in the month. So we've got a big variety of material that people will come and read, really.
What sort of styles do they have? Are they, I guess, you know, they might quite easily could be as, you know, reflective of society as a whole, rather than any sort of, you know, particular group or section?
Yeah, well, I'll read you a section from the Mill Road Renga, if you like.
Yeah, please do.
Which is written in quite a strict form, but which is a shared form, so everybody ends up with their own Renga, but one is put into the whole. So we've got things like shadow sliding on walls, some tall, some small, take care of your shadow. The street blossoms in sun, the heat keeping my mind still. Gloriously high, shining moon, so ice cream sweet, crowns the summer night. Walk barefoot, tread the long road, footsteps hold wisdom ahead. Mill road, along to the mill, the floss and the grinding wheel. I am where you are, like an ever-rising starlight, we rest together.
And this sort of thing would be taken by, you know, different people to be able to take a different line and read it? Is that how that play would work?
And I think also I will get people to read some of the self-portrait poems that they've written as well, which I actually haven't got with me at the moment. So it's a mixture of response to other subjects as well as writing about people's own experience, really.
And I guess, Neil, from a filming point of view, if you have got different people taking a different line each, that's rather good, isn't it? You can do cutaways and move from person to person, slightly different locations.
Yes. If it was one person doing a poetry reading, I mean, I don't want to decry it, obviously they're going to be very good, but it filmically, not wonderfully exciting, but having lots of different people in different, it'll be much more interesting for us, and of course for the students who are trying to gain experience, you don't want to just put the camera on a tripod and point it one direction and leave it. I mean, what are you learning if you do that?
Actually, in the cemetery there are some really sort of reflective places, like the tunnel that you walk up when you come off Mill Road into the cemetery.
Oh, then, yes.
You know, which is a fantastic kind of image for maybe some of the experience that my writers have had. And then at the back of Mill Road, there's a beautiful copper beech tree, which isn't surrounded by gravestones. And there's actually, at the moment, a lot of trees sort of at their full height, a huge variety of trees
in there.
You've
got a circular area as well, haven't you, somewhere in the centre as well, which I think is actually almost like an open space in about that way.
Yeah, and I mean, that's part of the reason that we ever first went there, because we were looking for an open space in Mill Road, and people said, oh, I go to Mill Road Cemetery, so that's where we went in the dead of winter, just to walk around and talk and get some inspiration, really.
And Neil, what's going to happen with the film once it's been recorded? Obviously, the editing process, but after that, is it going to be released for all to see?
We will certainly put it on the IFT website, and I don't know whether, presumed, I don't know whether Lifecraft might want to do the same. I mean,
we would like a copy.
To
be able to show to all the other members who aren't involved in the project, and also as a sort of record.
It's got a part of the process as well, isn't it?
It's part of the process.
Really? Just to say, I've done this. I've achieved this.
Yes, and it's nice when you're, only kind of working on a project for a short length of time to leave some sort of legacy behind, and maybe Lifecraft and the Independent Film Trust can enter it for the Cambridge Shorts next year, or if there's another disability festival or something. So it's just is all kind of part of the fabric of the creative work we're trying to do, really.
Mm. Well, Claire, Neil, thank you very much for coming into 105 this afternoon. Claire, do come back and tell us about the Blue Moon Cafe in a couple of weeks' time.
I will do,
Near the time for that. Thanks both very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
And it is the summer holidays, or at least it soon will be, and that means headaches for parents. And that's especially true for those who have separated and are apart from their kids. Now, it presents a few legal problems, legal issues, and Claire Brackley is here from Taylor Vinters this afternoon, Cambridge Solicitors. Hello.
Hello there.
Thanks very much for coming in. Good to see you again. It strikes me that this is the sort of thing that really needs sorting at the end of the Easter holidays rather than the beginning of the summer ones.
That is absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, the whole point about contact arrangements generally is that being prepared is absolutely key. It's an essential part of the divorce process itself to make sure that the arrangements for the children are in place, and where the children will live, when they'll spend time with each parent, all of that needs to be looked at the start. Lots of things about how they'll have contact with the other parent, whether they're going to be able to text, email, whether they'll have their own phones, when they'll see each other.
Texting and email comes under these things, really?
Absolutely.
This is like a modern divorce, isn't it, if ever there
really
was one?
Really important now, because if you think about the way the family's changed, children will want to text their parents and email their parents, and how is that going to be dealt with, especially if the parents' relationship at the start is not easy? Do you want the intrusion of text messages? How are you going to deal with mobile phone calls? All these things are definitely better discussed at the outset so that everybody is clear.
And I guess there's different ways this might be dealt with, insofar as it might, I know there's the odd case of 50-50 access, but predominantly it's going to be one parent with the lion's share and another parent making the phone calls, knocking on the door and trying to arrange when they can spend some time with the kids during the summer holidays.
That's right. I mean, there's a real variety of arrangements that are in place, because every case is different, every family is completely different. More and more, we were seeing shared care in its truest sense, where there are 50-50 arrangements, but that doesn't work for everyone. There is often a parent that works more than another, or whatever. It is really about what suits the family, and I suppose a more standard, if you can call it that, arrangement is alternate weekends, maybe a night in the week as well, with a child living with one parent and having contact with the other parent at arranged times. That is more usual, but as I say, it completely depends.
And holidays coming up, and some parents will perhaps, you know, want to maybe even spend some time together as a family, if that, you know, suits the arrangements. But I guess others will want to go to different parts of the country and even abroad, which I guess raises the issue of what happens with passports.
That's absolutely right. It's very important that both parents have an opportunity to take their children for quality time on holidays, out of the country, and getting those sorts of details agreed early on is absolutely key, because what you want to avoid is the situation where it is not agreed and you've booked a holiday and everything falls apart at the last minute. And the only way to deal with that is to get good agreement early.
Because that's the problem. You know, Dad could go knocking on the door, seeing Mum, and all of a sudden it's revealed that Jimmy has a football camp that he's going to, and I'm sorry, very sorry, forgot to mention it. What do? You're stuck, really, aren't you?
Yeah, forward planning is key. Making those arrangements and getting agreement about them at an early stage, because especially if you want to take the child out of the jurisdiction, for example, if you want to go on holiday abroad, then you have to have the consent of every person who has something called parental responsibility for that child. And parental responsibility, it's known as PR. It's a complicated or an issue that's outside the scope of what we're talking about. But basically, a mother has PR for a child when they are born, but a father can acquire that if he's married to the child's mother, or if he's on the birth certificate, or a variety of other ways. But if you have PR, you must get the consent of everybody before you take that child out of the country. And a lot of people don't realise that technically you could be guilty of abducting your child if you haven't. I mean, it sounds ludicrous, but if you
haven't
got consent...
And something wouldn't even be aware of it happening, I guess.
Absolutely right. You need to make sure that everyone who has PR for that child has consented and is in agreement that you're going to take them on holiday abroad, and that kind of thing needs forward planning. And you mentioned passports. I mean, that's another key issue. In an ideal world, you would have an agreement in place about who's going to hold the children's passports. You know, what is going to happen to them? It's always a thorny issue.
So the child would have their own passport. From an age where they have recognisable features?
Is that how it works? Children have passports now. Babies have passports.
Oh, really?
So, I mean, children have their own passports, and who is going to hold them? You can imagine, on a day-to-day level, perhaps makes very little difference, but it's quite an emotive subject, who is going to hold the children's passports. And it's something that you, if you want to take them on holiday, you really do need to sort out. You know, parents have different arrangements. Some will say the parent where the children reside most of the time will hold the passports. Some will say, I'll hold the birth certificates, you hold the passports. Some will say, if you travel more than I do, you can hold them. What you need to do is make sure that there is an arrangement in place that if you are going on a holiday, that 14 days before or whenever, that those passports are going to make
And it can get sticky, because every once in a while you have a story you might hear on the news where a father who from the Mfuli Republic, I'll make one up so I don't upset any countries, goes back to that country with the child, and the mother's thinking, oh no, they're not going to come back, I don't want them to go. And that's something, presumably it's back again when that original agreement is made.
Absolutely, it's key that the original arrangements are very clear as to what is going to happen, and that all of these issues about passports and things are sorted out, and who's going to take the child where and when. And there are things you can do, there are always applications you can make to the court, but it is infinitely better to come to an agreement that avoids court action later, because it's very costly emotionally and financially to make an application to the court, and often these things are very urgent at the last minute because you're about to go away, and it becomes a very difficult issue that needs forward planning. And we send a lot of clients now to mediation, and we provide mediation at Taylor Vinters.
Some people might not be able to afford the mediation services. They're worried enough about, you know, dare I say it, solicitors' costs.
Absolutely.
Without adding mediation on top of that as well.
It's a key issue, and actually mediation can work out far more cost effective for clients than having a conventional approach, because of course if you're going to mediation you've got one mediator that you're probably paying for collectively, so that hourly rate of that mediator is split between the two of you, and in our experience, you tend to make a lot more progress at mediation as well. And it's much more constructive to have an agreement that everybody has had some input into. If you're unable to, and you're in the unfortunate and very unhappy position of ending up in the court, you have given away your ability to have control over that situation, and it's much better to come up with something that might have to be a compromise, but that it's at least something that you've been involved in yourself.
The other sort of legal sticking point I was wondering about is adventure holidays. That is something which might result in, say, two different approaches, shall we say.
We might
have a mother who's worried about the slightest grazed knee and not wanting the child to topple over, and dad who's said, falling over, help protect them against germs, and let's go on this, outbound course or whatever over the next week or so. How does that back to the original agreement again?
It's not just adventure holidays. These things happen in day-to-day parenting as well. You may have a parent that says, my children need to be in bed at 7:30. You may have another parent that says, no, that's absolutely fine, I'm going to take them to a rock concert till 11. I mean, these are problems with separated parents. And it does, fortunately, come back to that same point about discussion, mediation, some sort of agreement between the parents at an early stage as to how the children are going to be looked after. And this issue, again, of parental responsibility, which encompasses a whole raft of things. It's duties, responsibilities, all of
those. And these things, I guess, can change as the child gets older. The approach to the grazed knee at 5 is probably different to
That's
what it might be at 12,
right.
Of course.
And also the parents' relationship with one another, you would hope, would evolve over time as well. And it will evolve perhaps into something that is more constructive over time. And parents' views on things change. So it's very much a moving process. And it's something that as the child gets older and the parents get more used to their change in circumstances, things will move along, one would hope. But there is always, as I say, the ability to go back into mediation, or if absolutely necessary, if parents really can't agree on something, then you can make an application to the court. You can make an application for something called a specific issue. If you really can't agree on something, taking the child somewhere, or the schooling, or some sort of arrangement, you can actually make an application to the court and have a court decide. But that it should always be a last resort.
Well, Claire, thank you very much for coming and talking us through actually is a bit of a sticky legal area, I suspect, as sticky as the heat out there this afternoon. But Claire, thank you very much. That's Claire Brackley from Taylor Vinters. 5:29, and I'm joined by Jeremy Mulvey. Jeremy is a local artist, is one of those taking part in the Cambridge Open Studios over, there have been 2 weeks, there's another 2 weeks, I think, to go. Jeremy, welcome to 105. Thanks for coming in.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about your work. It's always difficult, I suppose, describing artworks on the radio, but I've got your website in front of me here. And, well, how would you describe them? That's probably the best starting point.
Well, I have a number of different sorts of painting that I do. I guess the theme which has really compelled me to paint for a number of years is the theme of masculinity and gender identity. In the wake of feminism in the early 1990s, a number of us artists in
London. And you say that's interesting. You say 1990s as opposed to, say, 1970s or before.
Yes. I mean, I think that a lot of male artists, or one or two, picked up on what feminist artists had done, reviewing their life as girls and how that might have affected them and the choices they wanted to make as an adult to get out of the stereotypes. And a number of us men thought this would be a good idea for us to do. And so a group of us artists in London got together, sculptors, installation, performance, and we looked at social conditioning of men and possible futures, different ways of doing things, and we're using art really to explore these themes and creating exhibitions which sort of, I think the intention really was for them to be a starting point for some sort of debate.
And the role of men in society has changed. For example, we're clearly on a royal baby watch here, like everybody else at the moment. And the talk of William being rushed by helicopter from wherever he is to the hospital to join the Duchess of Cambridge. And years ago, that wouldn't have happened. The prince or the king would be out playing croquet somewhere, and the Lord Chancellor would pop round and tell him the good news. And that sort of reflected for men generally, but often. know, present with the birth and all sorts of things.
Oh, I think there have been some massive changes, and I think that they've often been as a reaction to how women have driven the debate forward and the action forward with equal rights and those sorts of things, both in terms of access and law. But the overall idea that men have of themselves has not been necessarily changed. We're still, I mean, I think young boys still to some extent have the model of James Bond rushing around in fast cars and almost proving their masculinity through the way they're able to compete in those sort of things. So you have a very mixed message, I feel, and it's interesting to explore those sorts of things.
Mm. Is it, I guess it, sometimes I think about television commercials in particular, and it's invariably the inept man being rescued by the woman who's purchased the product, which is a complete role reversal of the kind of advertisements that might appear, say, in the 1950s.
Yeah, and I think that's very flattering to women, and I think women will be quite aware that they might be patronised in that. But you're absolutely right. As far as the shopping adverts are concerned, often men are seen as the bumbling persons who have to be have to be helped to solve the way forward in buying things.
So let's, you know, looking through some of your artwork, for example, there's one I see on your website here entitled Letting Go, and it looks like somebody's sort of flying through the air to towards a destination, perhaps over a bridge. And then there's another one which I notice, Impact Men and War, and there's a man sitting on a sofa clutching a body, a woman's body, perhaps.
It's the body of his son, actually.
Body of his son, okay.
Yes, and the first one, Letting Go, that was really the idea of perhaps if we needed to rethink our lives as men, we needed to perhaps look at the pressure that's put on us from about 18 and if not a little before on having a career, on a trade or work, that we would define ourselves somehow through our work. And the idea was to, and I was very much management in art schools at the time and sort of rushing around in a neck suit with a briefcase with brass handle on and rushing around doing management things, very much involved in that lovely desk and computer and those sort of things, but not a lot of time for myself.
Do you feel that people are, I kind of think of my own sort of a career path, as it were, you're sort of, you know, in my case, there's a little bit of pressure for, you know, why is he going off to London doing this journalism thing for? And then after time, I actually kind of got fed up with the journalism thing to a certain extent because I wasn't doing the journalism. I was too busy managing other people who were doing the journalism.
Well, that's it.
And next stop, Cambridge.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that to some extent, you know, our conditioning, if you like, is to prepare us to submit to large institutional structures and get them to work and devote our time to that. I think Letting Go was, what would it be like if we didn't feel that compulsion to compete and lead? And it almost seemed like floating and dropping everything, both a bit perilous, but also that very exhilarating, not knowing exactly what was going to be around the corner. So falling through those bright skies, tumbling slowly, really, rather than something dramatic like that. The impact, that was another aspect of masculinity which I wanted to look at, which was the way in we're in various ways expected to think of ourselves in military situations through our games as kids, the war games in the playground. I'm sure that's got slightly less for younger boys now, but certainly for me with cadet training and those sorts of things in the films, you know, Die Hard and that sort of thing, that's the way. And
you're going to be Bruce Willis wandering around,
yeah,
the best.
Bruce Willis looking very handsome in a short haircut and very, very controlled and able to cope with situations that are really quite dramatic. That was an idea. And I was just wondering how that transfers itself to war. And that picture came out of the way that I didn't feel that we were dealing with the personal tragedies of some of the war adventures that we got involved in the Blair era in Afghanistan and other things. And that was about counting the cost of father mourning his dead son And I sort of based it on Michelangelo's Pieta.
I was going to ask, in terms, when it comes to producing something like this, obviously you can't, ask, in the case of Letting Go, you can't ask somebody to pose for you flying through the air. That just doesn't happen. It has to come from your imagination, or do you sort of look for inspiration in photographs?
Well, it comes from imagination, but also it comes from... paintings. Lots of paintings of religious ceilings have got people tumbling through the sky, or going up to heaven, or coming down from heaven in the Sistine Chapel. So I often use sort of Renaissance and Baroque models for my paintings, and then put them in modern clothing to sort of give some contrast. And also photographs. And there's some very good illustration manuals. I can't mention the people who produce these, which show figures in different sort of convulsing situations. So it's a mixture of both imagination, photography, and stealing or borrowing.
And then you can put your own inspiration onto it, I guess. Yeah, send it off in the direction that you want it to travel.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a figure tumbling through the sky in one of Caravaggio's paintings or Michelangelo, thought, oh, I could use that.
Yeah. What's you teach art, I believe.
Yes.
believe now. You know how when you have a class full of students, I'm presuming they're all wanting to go off in their own directions. Is it sort of difficult sometimes to bring it all together, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the key knacks of art school teaching, is to both enable people to go off in their own direction, as you say, to identify their own direction. I mean, one of the first questions you're asked first week of fine art course in most colleges is, what do you want to do? So the person sets the direction. And then I think the good teacher sort of encourages them to set their own criteria and puts technical techniques in their way as and when they need it. It took quite a number of decades for art school to get the right balance between enforcing some sort of unspoken set of rules which the staff were giving them to actually encouraging people to develop their own way of doing things.
And it must be a bit of a balancing act at times, I would have thought, because it's one of these things, I guess, obviously you've got wrong, or maybe you haven't in art, I don't know, and then you got right, and then after that, of course, you've got personal opinion.
That's right. Well, I think it's about balance. I mean, that's one of the skills I think art students get, is to be objective about their opinions about art, and to try and give some account for that in an education situation. Why is this working? Why isn't this working? And to go beyond just taste. That's for people looking and buying art, but to actually say, that doesn't work because of something that I need to adjust, or that could be improved in some sort of way. So I think the way the tutor works is to try and find out what the student wants and try and bring a critical agenda which is appropriate for those desires.
Now, we've got Open Studios, you're very much a part of that. I believe you've opened last weekend, doing the same again this weekend. So
I'm just doing weeks 2 and 3.
And what do people go to look around? Is it your home, or is it a separate art studio?
Well, it's very interesting. I think the three people who started it in 1973, the three women in Cambridge, had a brilliant idea, and I think that...
Because it is one of the oldest running of these sorts of events, isn't it, in the UK?
I think one of the best organised. I mean, I think it's a lovely mixture of looking at people's art, seeing the way they work, if you can have a look around the studio, and actually seeing their home. And I think for a lot of people it's less threatening than going over the threshold of a West End gallery, which can seem quite daunting. So there's an intimacy about it.
So it's less Tate Modern and more through the keyhole.
Exactly. I think so. That's absolutely right. And, you know, you get questions about the art, then you get questions about how did somebody do that ceiling. So, you know, there's different DIY things.
Sort of a mix which almost comes into it. Yes, it must be an interesting thing of the concept of how somebody is artists and, paints pictures and how they decorate their home. There's a completely different skill to some
extent,
isn't it?
Well, that's it. And I mean, I think the art of curation is placing your objects in your home so that it both fits in with it, but also does the art justice.
Yes, no, that's a very interesting thing. And you've been involved for Open Studios for some time, or how many years have you been doing this?
My first Open Studio in 2000. In 2000, yeah. So this is about my 14th one.
That's pretty good going, actually, isn't it?
It's not bad. The first few years, it was quite daunting and worrying. Very few people came. I nearly gave up. But in the fourth year, it started to get, you know, you've got regular visitors and some sales and those sorts of things.
OK, well, if people want to see your particular place, very good. Robbie has kindly opened it at the correct place for me. On Maid's Causeway. So
yeah,
that's not
59 Maid's Causeway.
That's not too far. And I guess people should probably... they don't have to book or anything like that. Or do they? How does it work?
Well, there's loads of guides around Cambridge.
This is a yellow book. Which
it's
we
a yellow book.
Do have a supply in the studio if people can't find any, I think.
Absolutely. And it's very well produced. And that format has been... so people can sort of plan their day of who they want to see and how they're going to get around Cambridge and the outskirts as well.
Oh, funny enough, I see on the opposite page John Pocock, who was in here a couple of weeks ago, talking about some of his work. But you've also got a website, of course, if people want to have a little look there.
Yes,
tell us
yes.
what that is, please.
That's www.jeremymulvey.co.uk, and that has the range of my work, portraits, landscapes, still lives, and these adventure pictures of men floating through the air, letting go, and falling. Free fall is the other one. I forgot my own title.
We should also mention the website for Cambridge Open Studios, which is www.camopenstudios.co.uk. But just pop Cambridge Open Studios into your search engine of choice, and I'm sure that will give you the details as well. I should also mention that probably even as we speak, Neil and Julie Whiteside are out and about. They're doing a couple of open studios, and you'll be able to hear what they saw as part of our Summer Saturday programme on Saturday afternoon between 3 and 5. But Jeremy Mulvey, thank you very much for coming to Cambridge 105 this afternoon. I'm pleased to welcome my next guest onto the show. His name is Sanderson Jones, and he is performing tonight in Cambridge as part of the Cambridge Comedy Festival. He's on a train, but the line seems okay to me. Hello, Sanderson.
Hello, how's it going?
Pretty good. I'm enjoying the, it's probably a pleasant ride through the Essex countryside on your way into Cambridge.
Yes, it, well, at the moment, I am waiting in one of those loos on the train, which when you use, you're never quite sure that you've actually shut the door.
Ah, yes, they can be very dangerous.
Those ones with the space age Star Trek doors, and yeah.
Yeah, and they're the foot pedals as well to work the wash basin.
It's all very confusing, isn't it? It's all very confusing.
Yeah, no, I kind of hate loos generally, but particularly ones on trains, I think. So heading to Cambridge.
Yes, we are. We're heading to the junction where we're going to be on at 9 p.m. tonight, which is all very exciting. I'm going up there with Pippa, who is my comedy partner, and we're doing our Edinburgh preview called Joy and Wonder.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because I've seen the Cambridge Comedy Festival in general as described as a bit of a warm-up for Edinburgh, really. But I was just wondering if you're going to end up with the same type of audience here as you might get when you go north of the border.
I think that... I mean, I'm not sure, you know. You slightly always get the sort of people who like the stuff you do wherever you go. Mm. So, for instance, the same person who looks at Sanderson Jones and Pippa Evans in a brochure... in Edinburgh and goes, oh, they're not the worst thing in the world. It's probably going to be the same person who looks at us at Cambridge and goes, oh, you know, a person with a beard. I go to see that type of comedy.
Can I say it's quite an impressive beard as well. It is quite well kept. It's not like that Bill Bailey where his is all over the place. Yours is very tidy and neat.
And look, as part of the beard front, we are told never to denigrate another man's beard. I mean, if I said anything against his beard, there would be, repercussions would occur rapidly. He has an army of troll followers who just defend the honour of his beard.
It could be a very dangerous business. Now, Pippa...
It would be a dangerous business, but it would be with wonderful musical accompaniment.
Now, Pippa, I notice you run what's described as an atheist church with her, called the Sunday Assembly.
Yeah, we do that. It's been labelled by the press, the atheist church. We prefer to think of it as a celebration of life. For us, we're not here for terribly long, and it's not about, saying you've got to believe this or you've got to believe that. It's more just let's, really enjoy and appreciate what we've got. And so it's been, this year's been a heck of a ride.
And this is every Sunday. It's in East London, isn't it, I think?
it's in East London. It's monthly at the moment.
Monthly, okay.
The last one we had 600 people to, which was amazing. And the thing which has been really crazy is that people all over Britain and all over the world have said that they wanted to have one. And so, in fact, tonight there are some people who want to start a Sunday assembly in Cambridge. They're coming along to the junction, and they're having a bit of a meeting, and we're meeting them. And, yeah, there's really very, very weird.
Oh, I like the sound of this. Send them my way if it all goes ahead. Send them the direction of Gwydir Street. I'm happy to have them here for a little chat about it all.
Okay, well, look, that's great. It is all going ahead. We're doing this thing from October to December this year. Pippa and I, we're doing a tour called 40 Dates and 40 Nights.
Oh, and getting a bit religious there.
It's cheeky. It's not insulting.
I guess atheism is probably the only religion left where you can tell jokes without offending anybody.
I mean, we're very open-minded about all of these things. We're not, you know, if Jesus suddenly appeared next to me in this loo, I would go, oh, I was wrong. So and I think there's an awful lot of atheists who just want to talk about what they don't believe in, but we think it's far better to talk about the stuff we do believe in.
So we were talking about the 40 Days and 40 Nights tour that you're doing with your comedy partner Pippa Evans in the autumn. Where are you planning to head on that?
Well, in the US, there are already people who would like one in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Silicon Valley, Chicago, New York, Minneapolis, Buffalo. In the UK, there's Oxford, Cambridge, where else? Brighton, Bristol, Exeter, Southend, Manchester. And then all over Australia. So we're just going to go over there and just, because the thing is, the reason we're going over there is we want to show people how we do it.
Mm.
So that way, when other people on their own, they've at least had a look and go, okay, so you do, you have music then, because we put a lot of work into trying to make it as good as possible, and we want to make sure that, you know, it stays the thing that we've created. You know, we don't want there to be, as we say, it only takes one child sacrifice to pee in the pool for everyone.
So,
you know, we want to make sure that no one stands up and says something horrible about Muslims or gay people or anything like that. You know, ours is all about being super inclusive. We're not anti-religious. We think that, in fact, you know, churches are really great things. Do you know, if you go to church, you're more likely to live longer, be healthier, be wealthier, and be happier. Like, it's just a shame that people who aren't religious don't get all of those benefits.
Yeah, the religion side of things sometimes gets in the way. So Edinburgh is coming up. Tonight you're in Cambridge as part of the Cambridge Comedy Festival at the Cambridge Junction.
Yeah.
First time you've played Cambridge?
It is going to be the first time that I've played Cambridge. The only other time I played Cambridge, I came for an interview and they told me to sod off. So when I tried to come here for university. So hopefully it won't go as badly as that.
I'm tempted to ask which college, but maybe that's wise if I don't. Just check it wasn't Downing College, was it?
No, it was King's.
King's, okay.
Yeah.
Well, they missed out. They missed out. You could have done theology or something.
I'll go in front of them and just go and sort of give them a birdie as I go past and, you know, not look at all bitter or disappointed at my young self.
Yeah, wonder past. Sanderson, thank you very much for speaking to us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
What time are you on stage again?
We're on stage at 9 p.m. And so if anyone is at the junction, and also if anyone wants to think that they'd like to have, a gathering which has got all the best bits of church but with no religion and better songs. Oh yeah, we like sing Queen and David and all that. Then if they go on to sundayassembly.com, there's a part which says start your own assembly and get in touch with us. We'll put you in touch with people. And then we will hopefully be back in October.
October. Well, look, when you're back in October, give us a shout. Maybe you can bring yourself and some of the congregation into the studio for a chat live. That would be really good. Sanderson Jones, thank you very much for joining us on 105 tonight.